This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Picture a paved, dead-end road, wedged between two forested hills. It's wintertime, so that's old, crunchy snow that you're hearing. On the side of the road, there's a little concrete house with a metal roof, maybe 4 feet tall, and beside it, poking through a slab of broken pavement, a white plastic pipe. It is not what you typically think of when you hear the phrase sacred place. But the residents of this town have been coming here for hundreds of years to get something that these days comes freely out of your tap.
Can we pester you for a second?
Sure.
That's producer Taylor Quimby talking to a guy that's holding a big plastic jug underneath the pipe, filling it with crisp, cold spring water.
Like, what's the benefit? Just the taste of the water?
I like to think it's healthier, at least, than the chlorinated stuff we could coming out of the taps. I also use it when I grow a lot of vegetables and stuff in my basement. So I'll use it for that.
Whether you're feeding your basement vegetables or just quaffing a glass from the tap, water is, objectively, the most important resource needed for human survival. So it's understandable that people will go out of their way to get the very best there is.
I did not close that.
For a lot of the townsfolk of Exeter, New Hampshire, that means coming here, to the Jailhouse Spring, a spot not far from where the town founder took up residence in 1638. The history is rich, and the water is always flowing.
Do you mind if I ask you a couple questions while you fill?
Sure.
You drink nothing but this water?
I don't like to drink the town water. Obviously, I boil it sometimes and use it in cooking, but I get quarterly reports that are not perfect every single quarter.
And a long history has helped transform this inconspicuous pipe into something sacred, something old school cool.
What are the things in the report that concern you?
Well, the level of these chemicals that they say are going to be fixed. I can't remember right now the scientific name for it, because they're complicated names.
But maybe that history has done something else too. Maybe it's inspired a bit of what skeptics would call magical thinking.
Why does it feel like this water's better than the town water?
Because it comes out of the ground and it hasn't been run through treatments, and it just seems like it must be pure.
Some life choices are better for the environment or better for our bodies, but sometimes we just hope that's the case. Well, today, to kick off our new season of Outside In, we're challenging those assumptions, and we're starting with springs. For thousands of years, some natural spring waters have been associated with health. But recently, in response to something called the raw water movement, scientists and health officials have emphasized that drinking from untested springs can make you sick. So which is it? Are springs a pure source for a healing tonic, or a passing fad and a dangerous throwback? Producer Taylor Quimby and I are here to find out. Since this story has been a real learning process for Taylor, I think we should start at the beginning. TQ, how did this story get started?
So sometime last year, I was Googling spring water, as you do, and I came across a guy named Daniel Vitalis.
This is fresh water from the earth the way it was meant to be, and it's the kind of water that we're biologically adapted to as an animal.
Now, Daniel Vitalis is a very engaging character. He's got an impressive beard, I must say, and he's the host of the show called the Rewild Yourself Podcast.
You're listening to the Rewild Yourself Podcast.
There's episodes about hunting squirrels.
My hunting method for squirrel right now, because
there's an episode about eating acorns.
They're free. There's no agriculture needed.
You don't have to buy any equipment.
You don't even have to. Yeah, you can use rocks.
There's an episode about barefoot shoes. Big fan.
Probably the correct pronunciation is indeed Vibram.
To me, it's like a vibe is cool. Like, hey, we got good vibes. But I got to say,
Daniel Vitalis has this benevolent prepper /hyper-local-food-advocate thing going on. And one of the things he is super passionate about is spring water.
The water from springs is the cleanest water in the world. It's been filtered by the earth itself, so water percolates down through the earth and is filtered by all that earth substrate, and it accumulates in deep aquifers. And when those aquifers are full, that water is brought up to the surface.
So about a decade ago, Daniel Vitalis started this website called findaspring.com, which is this crowdsourced platform where people can submit their local springs, leave comments about how they taste or whether the water is safe, put like a GPS pin down so people can find directions there. And there are just hundreds of these springs that people have submitted across the country. And Daniel, on this website, he has all these videos about how to become a spring water fanatic just like him.
All right, here's an equipment list that can really help you in your spring water gathering practice. First thing is going to be a TDS meter. Now, a TDS meter measures the total dissolved solids in the water that you're drinking. And the way it does that is it has an...
So, Taylor, what exactly are you thinking about Daniel Vitalis at this point?
Well, he's got the air of a very well-informed hobbyist. You know, he sounds like he's got a pretty great grasp of science. So I call him up, and soundbite by soundbite, he is just blowing my mind.
I understand that this water isn't alive in the sense that the H2O is not alive, but if you'll allow it, the water that I'm talking about is an ecosystem.
He's talking about how there's no such thing as pure, unadulterated water. Of course not. Oh, wow, it's amazing. He's talking about why restaurants put lemon or lime in their water to make it taste better.
Right, they know the water's not really that good. You know, add lemon or lime to it and put some acidity into it, and that'll kind of make it feel wetter in your mouth.
It's like, up until this point, I have literally never thought this much about water in my life.
We know now what happens when you remove all the stuff, let's say, from sugarcane, and you just eat the sucrose crystal, white sugar. We know what happens when you take wheat and you remove everything and you just eat the white flour. We're very comfortable with the idea that those processed foods are less nutritious to us and have deleterious effects on our bodies. But we haven't really, for whatever reason, thought about what happens when we alter the composition of water.
So I remember you getting out of this interview with this dude and just being like, oh man, he's so cool. Like, you were totally taken with him.
Well, yeah. I was.
When you look at what most people are, they're kind of like bags of dirty water walking around making mistakes. Oh, that was mean to say that. Who says that?
No. I like to, I'm going to picture that as I walk down the street next time.
That's how I see it.
So what I think Daniel Vitalis has done is take this age-old fascination with natural springs and adapted it for a 21st century audience, especially the subset of folks who are big into local food, yoga, maybe back-to-the-land lifestyles, and all that kind of stuff.
There is an aura of mystery that goes around springs because, you know, where is the water coming from?
This is Frank Chappell, a research hydrologist who's been studying the chemistry of groundwater for 30 years.
If you're in the desert, you know, and you're in an oasis, you know, it's like it's a miracle. And so why wouldn't a miracle water be good for you?
Before the advent of chlorination, when people in population centers especially were getting most of their water from reservoirs, lakes, rivers, types of water that are stored on the Earth's surface, diseases could get into that water and spread through a population really, really fast.
Just look up cholera epidemics on the internet and you'll get the idea of why treating public water was important. I mean, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people dying all across the globe.
You know, it used to be that taking a drink of water, you were taken at risk through most of human history. And so if you've had a spring which was demonstrably correct, then you stuck with that because that was worth something.
It wasn't just worth something. It was worth huge money. In the mid-1800s, Saratoga Springs in New York produced millions of glass bottles of spring water every year and sold them at a just crazy markup to wealthy consumers.
At $1.75 per pint, adjusted for inflation, that's about $375 a gallon.
In some cases, spring water wasn't just less dangerous, though. It could actively make you healthier.
You know, iodine in Saratoga spring water, you know, was observed to cure simple goiters in people. Another good example is in the 1800s, you know, before we had Geritol, women going into menopause often would come up with a kind of anemia, which was called chlorosis, because it kind of turned them slightly green. And it was observed that that condition could be cured by drinking water from certain springs. And as it turns out, that water, as you might expect, contained relatively high concentrations of dissolved iron.
But a lot changed when developed countries started chlorinating water. It started in Germany and England around the start of the 20th century and took off. If you ever played Oregon Trail growing up, which I did, you know how hard it was to survive the game without dying of dysentery. Well, the reason that you don't hear about that in the U.S. anymore, or cholera or typhoid for that matter, is because of water chlorination. From that point on, the clear-cut advantage that spring-fed groundwater had over public water systems wasn't so clear-cut anymore.
You know, when I talked with Daniel Vitalis, I asked him to do something that I now realize doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but I thought it did at the time. I asked him to rank sources of water from best to worst.
I cannot believe.
It was like a trap that I didn't know I was setting.
You're a babe in the wilderness, Taylor.
If you think about it, if you're drinking water out of an aquifer that's been down there for 300-400 years, then that water's older than the Industrial Revolution. So for me, the hierarchy goes like this. The clean, deep, old, locked-up aquifer water that we get at springs. Next for me would be water from an artesian well. After that, it's kind of gets murky. It's like it's up to you to decide if you want to go tap water and filter it or if you want to go bottled water, because both have some downsides.
But when I posed that same question later to Frank Chappelle and I told him what Daniel had said, he was like genuinely alarmed.
Oh, it's not true. That's just not correct. The vast majority of springs that you find, especially in the eastern United States where it's, you know, humid, the residence time of the water in the ground is very short. I mean, sometimes on the order of days. And in general, the younger the water, the greater the possibility that it is going to have some kind of chemical or fecal contamination.
Sure, springs can be an incredibly good source of clean water, but you can't take that for granted. You have to look at the specifics. Possible pollutants can come from local geology, nearby farms, animal poo, which is why even findaspring.com has a lengthy disclaimer on the website.
Daniel has a way of sounding a bit like a scientist, but he also makes these broad pronouncements, the kinds of things that real scientists like Frank would never say, not to mention doctors and health officials. What they will all tell you is you shouldn't drink spring water without knowing what's in it.
To make a blanket statement that spring waters are always better is simply not correct.
We picked a good day for our road trip. A little slick.
I was going to say, I feel like we picked a terrible day for our road trip because there's snow all over the roads.
So one of the things that might not come across over the radio is just how different these roadside springs can be from one another. So this winter, Taylor decided the two of us would take a little road trip to check out some of New Hampshire's roadside springs. And while we were at it, collect some samples for testing.
Oh, no, I see it. It's on the left. You lied to us, Siri.
Wait, did I just pass it?
Yeah, you did.
That was it?
That was it.
Man, they're so nondescript. That was like a little fence and a sign that said, looked like it said bump. Did it say pump? Hey, it does say bump. It's called Fist Bump Spring.
Yeah, and to describe it, it's just looks like a steel pipe. This is some rust, some corrosion. You got the gas station, you got like a busy road.
You wanna try it?
Yep, tastes like water.
I don't love it.
Spring number two, moving on.
Actually, I think this tastes better than the other one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I won't say why, but I feel like it tastes better.
Yeah, there's something there.
This is a bad idea. We're gonna get hit by a car. And there's probably no spring because it's covered in snow.
Oh, man. I'm not seeing anything.
You're sure it's on the side of the road?
Yeah, that's what it said.
Sacred, sacred.
Holy shit, that is dope. Okay, that is actually pretty cool.
There's a grate and there's like leaves and some trash floating in it. And on the grate, there's a lot of algae.
Taylor, we got someone waiting for us.
Dude, I gave her the sign. What did you do here?
Sign? I said, I waved. We're done. We're obviously done.
I would not feel safe. Taste testing this until I've been assured that there's no bacteria in the water. Agreed.
Yeah, I'll get the bacteria bottle.
All in all, we visited 5 locations from findaspring.com. One of them, listed on the website as a Daniel Vitalis favorite, was housed in an amazing spring house topped with this Turkish-style onion dome.
But don't judge a spring by its spring house, because that was also the one with like an open pool of water with trash floating in it.
And all along the way, we collected samples, which at the end of the day, we brought to a water quality lab to get tested.
All set.
All right. Thanks so much.
And from there,
thank you.
We just waited.
Onward.
Now, this would probably be a good time to tell you all that while we were working on this story, this whole spring water health craze thing blew up. A couple days after Christmas, the New York Times published an article called Unfiltered Fervor: The Rush to Get Off the Water Grid. They reported on a growing number of people that sell or promote what they call raw water. And boy, oh boy, was there a freak out.
Tap or not to tap, the so-called raw water trend.
Raw water.
Raw water.
With something called raw water.
As people drinking untreated,
unfiltered, unsterilized
water collected from natural springs.
Drinking that sounds insane.
Officials at the Centers for Disease Control say water is filtered for a reason.
It could put you at risk for diseases like hepatitis and neurovirus.
Giardia, E. coli.
That could definitely make you sick.
What is wrong with people?
Or kill you.
Don't do it.
Wouldn't you know it, Daniel Vitalis of findaspring.com had a quote in the New York Times article. The Juicero guy from Silicon Valley has a new raw water startup. He was in the article. And these two, Brian Pullen and Seth Pruzanski, a couple of guys bottling untreated spring water in Maine under the name Tourmaline Springs.
People tell us all the time they need half as much water that they normally need.
When they use this water?
Yeah, when they drink it, they feel satiated with much less volume.
The spring that Seth and Brian are bottling is another one of those historic springs that goes way back. And in fact, they've been selling their brand of raw water for a few years now. It's only since the New York Times article came out that things really went nuts.
So here we had CBS, we had Fox News, we had Comedy Central tried to make fun of us. Boston Globe just put us on the front page. Front page.
Ignorance of people. Everybody just keeps regurgitating and recycling the same nonsense, really having no idea what they're talking about.
Some of the companies mentioned in the New York Times article, I think it's fair to say that they make a very easy target. The owner of a brand called Live Water told the Times that his water only stays fresh for one lunar cycle and that good water should turn green after a while. Which is also something Daniel Vitalis told me, but it sounded less ridiculous then.
God. And it's also easy to make fun of the people who can afford to buy Live Water, which retails for a staggering $37 for 2.5 gallons. Not as much as it cost back in the cholera days, but next to tap water, it's a pretty staggering markup.
Yeah, a lot of the coverage I saw of this was very much about, like, rich folks in Silicon Valley are so privileged they can afford to drink water that makes you sick.
There's a new pseudoscientific health craze for the wealthy that could definitely make you sick.
That backlash caught up everyone, including the guys at Tourmaline Springs, who saw a sudden spike in attention, but also say they got death threats from people who said they were going to make people sick, which isn't really fair, because while their water might not be treated, it is tested to the same standard as their bottled water competitors.
So we test for the presence of coliform when we bottle each time, and then quarterly we test for coliform again, and we also do swab tests of containers, bottles, and caps. And then annually we do the full battery for 200 chemicals, and they're doing everything there, you know, at upwards of parts per quadrillion.
We've never advocated drinking from a stream or even a spring that isn't checked, because it's a stupid thing in this day and age.
Even a roadside spring, you see a pipe there, but you have no idea what's going on between there and the source.
I think when we look at the backlash from like ER docs and like that kind of thing, like the CDC types, their concern is that people are going to hear this raw water, like untreated water, and think, oh, that's better. They're afraid that people are going to like start drinking out of streams again and get poisoning from, get Giardia and that kind of thing.
Yes, I agree with you. You're right. Yes, I agree with you, of course. But you could qualify what you say instead of just screaming at the top of your lungs about how dangerous this is, that nobody ever discusses how many people get sick from tap water every year.
Tourmaline Springs might not make you sick, but that doesn't mean that Brian and Seth aren't performing some sort of verbal gymnastics to justify their product. On the one hand, they will tell you that there is nothing magical about their water, but then moments later they'll call it a healing tonic, and they'll talk to you about its unique mineral content. On their website or on the news, they've argued that the source of their water is thousands of years old, that it flows from the White Mountains, or is maybe even created by magma deep inside the Earth's mantle. But then they'll admit that they can't really prove the origin of their spring at all.
I know it's frustrating for you because you can't quantify. You know, we don't understand that necessarily where things are coming. All we know is what's presenting itself to the surface and what the chemical purity is through modern day testing. But where this occurs from is still just a bit of magic in that. You know, that we don't really know.
But if there's a reason why their message sticks right now, a reason why the idea of raw water resonates with a certain brand of consumer, it's probably because trust in our public water systems has taken a pretty hard hit in recent years. And it's not just in places like Flint, Michigan. In 2016, Reuters conducted an investigation that found nearly 3,000 areas across the country where lead exposure was higher than Flint. A paper just published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences showed that in 2015, some 21 million people drank water from systems that don't meet health-based quality standards.
People like the residents of Exeter, New Hampshire. That's the site of the first spring we visited way back at the beginning of the episode. An EPA database that scores water utilities, based on violations and compliance, gave Exeter's water department the worst rating among New Hampshire's large utilities. Sam, you remember that lady who said that every quarter she would read about the bad stuff in the public water in Exeter?
Yeah.
I get quarterly reports that are not perfect every single quarter.
Well, the contaminant that she couldn't remember the name of is a byproduct of chlorine called a trihalomethane.
The chlorine reacts with some of the constituents that are still in the water and or stuck on the inside of the pipes.
That's Paul Roy.
I'm the water treatment operations supervisor for the town of Exeter, New Hampshire.
And in Exeter's case specifically, the levels of trihalomethanes are high enough that the city has acknowledged there is an increased risk of getting some cancers if you drink their water.
This would be a 150-pound person drinking roughly 10 liters of water a day for 70 years, and they get a 1% chance more of getting cancer.
Now, you may hear that and say, well, that's an acceptable risk. I'm going to drink it anyway, or not. 10 liters is a lot, and so is 70 years. But either way, the town is doing everything they can to get that number down. But in the meantime, they still have to publish these reports quarter after quarter that say, yes, this contaminant is a carcinogen. And if you're this woman getting these updates four times a year since 2014, you might just think that drinking from the jailhouse spring is the safer option.
I know they're trying to clean up the water system and provide a new water system, but God, water is the most important thing we have.
What do you tell people when they call with concerns?
Depending on your age, it's going to be entirely up to you. The possibility exists that you can use a point of use filter. Bottled water, if you want, is technically safe. Other than that, it's totally up to the individual.
So a few days after our road trip, I got a couple emails back from the water quality lab. We got our results.
So point two is how much they can detect.
For all the really scary stuff that can get into your water, everything was within legal limits.
There was like basically none.
No uranium.
No E. coli.
No manganese.
No arsenic. Isn't that more stuff? Where's it? Wait, hang on. Are total dissolved solids on here?
No, so this has conductivity.
A few highish numbers for other stuff here and there, but no smoking guns. Nothing that screamed unsafe.
This one has like 1.2, which is a quarter of the acceptable limit.
The only primary test that would violate EPA standards was that all three springs were positive for total coliform bacteria.
So,
whoa.
Which is a really broad test. It's basically like, yeah,
there's bacteria in there. And the more there is, the greater the possibility that some of that bacteria could make you sick.
But it might not.
Wait, we drank this water, too.
We liked it. This was our favorite water.
Well, coliform bacteria is apparently delicious.
And in the end, we came away thinking, well, most of these are probably fine to drink from. I mean, we did.
Yeah, except for the one with the onion dome.
No, I'm going to trust my gut on that one and say too risky.
The trash was not encouraging.
It wasn't too much trash, though.
It's just a wee cigarette butt here or there.
It was just like a light smattering of trash.
So if you lived in Exeter, would you drink from the spring or would you drink the trihalomethane?
I guess it probably depends how close to the spring I lived. You know, I mean, if there's one thing that I've learned doing this story, it's that there's no easy generalizations, that the more information you have, the better. But I've got to say, like, the more information I have doesn't make it easy to see, like, there's a clear choice of, like, oh, this is safe and this isn't.
Yeah. Like, the days of clear choices are long past. The days of clear choices were, you know, dysentery and cholera days.
Right.
And now we're looking at these contaminants that are present and in low doses over many years increase your risk of cancers, but you may never actually know if that cancer that you got came from your water or from some other environmental contaminant. And so it just becomes about managing all these disparate low-level risks and trying to make these margin calls of what risks you find acceptable.
Yeah. And it just, I mean, you start to get the sense that this idea that you can live in any way, shape, or form some sort of pure, unadulterated life, whether that's spring water or food or anything else, it's just impossible because environmental contaminants are everywhere all the time.
Yeah, and we just kind of have to come to terms with that.
Hmm. Well, the good thing about this whole show to me is that it's all academic in my case because I don't drink water, I just drink coffee. It's filtered. It goes through the filter at the top of the coffee
pot. Through the beans. All the stuff winds up in the beans.
A quick postscript on this story. The Rewild Yourself podcast has closed up shop. FindASpring.com is still up and running.
One thing we learned about testing water, though, the environment changes. You can't just test things once and call it a day. But if you are curious, we have posted our results from our spring water road trip at our website, as well as photos, outsideinradio.org. Coming up, our search for magical thinking takes us to the curb. Stick around. Welcome back to Outside In. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Today, we investigate the realms of magical thinking, areas where many of us have convinced ourselves that we're doing something good, making a difference, when the reality is less clear-cut. There probably isn't a better example of an easy, feel-good action than recycling. Throw that glass bottle in the green bin, and you just did a little something for the planet. Way to go! But the reality is, recycling doesn't work because we believe in it. It works because it's an industry. You might be keeping your plastic bottle out of the trash bin, but the commodities market keeps it out of the landfill. But what happens when the way we recycle no longer fits the rest of the equation? Where does our trash go when our partners aren't buying? Han McCarthy picks up the story.
When I was in grade school in Massachusetts, there was this movie they would show us, it felt like at least once a year. The sound of birds singing, trees silhouetted against the sunrise, and then bam! Huge piles of garbage and bulldozers roaming the hellscape of an endless landfill. And if you think that's dramatic, just wait. That is indeed a recycling song sung to the tune of Billy Joel's We Didn't Start the Fire. And then you get to watch a bunch of sketches and video clips about how much garbage we produce and how we've got to reduce that waste. The show was called Recycle This! Exclamation point. The thing was commissioned by the Dow Chemical Corporation, by the way, in 1990. And it might sound dorky.
21. Doc, what?
What is all this trash around the DeLorean?
Oh, I don't know.
But it worked. I wanted to reduce, reuse, recycle. I wanted to save the planet. Around the same time that I was sold on the moral obligation of saving the world from trash, a new way of recycling was born. A technology that would save us from the odious sorting. None of that plastic versus paper versus glass rigmarole. It was called single stream. One bin for all of your recycling. That single stream bin opened up a whole world of convenient environmental responsibility. Unlimited by categories, we can keep all sorts of stuff out of our trash cans. And indeed we do. But what if I told you that all of that well-meaning recycling is actually contributing to a major mess?
You can see right here, this pile is trash. This is all trash that someone has put in their recycling bin, as well as, you know, the things on the ground here.
In January, I went to Eco Maine. It's a recycling facility in Portland, Maine. Katrina Van Huysen took me on a tour of the place, starting with the MRF. That is the consistently funny acronym for Materials Recycling Facility. MRFs are amazing. Little puffs of air controlled by computers eject different plastics off of conveyor belts and into the appropriate bins. And then giant spinning rubber cogs bounce paper from glass and plastic. It's like a kid's idea of a candy factory, but for waste. All of this machinery does a pretty decent job. By the end of the day, it churns out a bale weighing 1 or 2 tons that's mostly one kind of material, but mostly doesn't cut it.
But someone put this stuff in the recycling bin. We've got a wood pallet, we've got a pillow, we've got a giant thing of styrofoam, we've got a Christmas wreath. You know, these things are not recyclable, and they come to us and humans pick them out by hand.
This is called wishful recycling. It's when you throw trash into the bin because it feels better than throwing it into the trash. And this wishful thinking is turning the recycling industry upside down. That moment when you pause with some plastic wrap or an old Barbie or maybe a battery full of toxic chemicals and you throw it in the recycling, that trash is called contamination.
Contamination overall is that piece of styrofoam right there, that tiny piece of fabric right there, the saran wrap or the piece of paper there. That's really the contamination we're talking about.
Contamination is the red sock in the washer full of white shirts. It's the plastic grocery bag in a bale of cardboard. It means that a bale has to be sorted through before the material can be washed and melted down or shredded into pulp. And the way that most of us recycle, single stream, co-mingled bin style, it leads to plenty of contamination. And the thing is, for a long time, contamination wasn't that big a deal for American MRFs. Because the people who buy those bales of material and turn them into new stuff, they've been okay with the contamination rate coming out of most facilities. And our single biggest buyer in particular was willing to clean up our mess. Was being the operative word here. Because they're not playing ball anymore.
It's been bad for a couple of months. It's getting worse. Once it gets really bad, people are going to start screaming when their budgets are upside down.
Meet Tony Belanger. He works for Pinard Waste Systems in New Hampshire. Last fall, I called Tony up wanting to talk about leaf collection. He wanted to talk about something a little bigger.
This is a dirty little secret, so to speak. I mean, it's out there, and people in our industry are well aware of it. But until it hits home with somebody like a municipality or a big corporation or something like that, someone who's got some lungs, it just doesn't get out to the general public.
The dirty little secret is the state of the recycling industry. More specifically, the state of the market. Something has happened to make recycling, well, not really worth it. The bedrock of recycling economics for decades has been that for towns and cities, recycling is cheaper than throwing things into a landfill. So, sure, it made environmentalists happy, but it made the taxpayers happy too. Tony says, recently, that's flipped.
if he gets stuck with this material, and it's going to cost him $90, $100 plus trucking to get rid of it, and yet he can still get rid of his trash at $65, $70 a ton and dump it locally, that's what he's going to do.
That means that your bottles and cans and cardboard that you've thoughtfully tossed in the recycling bin are not guaranteed to avoid the landfill, which is insane, right? I mean, how could all of this be going on without our knowing?
I'll be honest with you, not a lot of people care to know the inner workings of the waste industry.
Tony's right. I thought I knew how recycling worked. But until you start reading Recycling Today and Waste 360 with your morning coffee, you've only just scratched the surface.
They have this picture in their head of, you know, the little triangle on the bottom of a beverage container or food container and say, oh, look at that. I'm buying something that's reusable or recyclable, and that's the romantic part of it.
One majorly unromantic part of it? All of that stuff that we're wishfully recycling is messing with the industry. Contamination has always been a problem, but lately it's throwing a wrench in the entire operation, like with plastic bags.
That's what started all this to begin with, the contamination rate. These mostly grocery bags and stuff.
That's right. Anybody who has ever tried to recycle a plastic grocery bag, we're talking to you. You're recycling public enemy number one. We don't actually process all of our recycling on U.S. soil. We send about a third of it overseas to countries who are willing to pay for the stuff. One big-time buyer of our recycling, of recycling from countries all around the world, is China. China dominates world manufacturing. That takes a lot of plastic, paper, cardboard, rubber, and metal. And for a long time, it was cheaper for the country to repurpose used materials than to create brand new stuff. But at the same time, pollution is a huge problem in China. They've got enough waste issues of their own without adding all of the unusable and sometimes hazardous material that came along with our recyclables. So they started to do something about it. In 2011, they launched Green Fence, a program that aimed to carefully inspect all imported trash. In 2016, they tightened import restrictions. In 2017, a ban on certain imports. And finally, in 2018, they announced a new program with a new name, National Sword, which tells you exactly how seriously China is taking their waste problem. It calls to mind some colossus straddling a harbor with some kind of trash-specific thou shall not pass thing going on. The program bans all sorts of plastic and lowers acceptable contamination to practically nothing. It means that the country is going to prioritize recycling its own waste over that from other countries.
So just recently, China has put into effect a new threshold on the level of contamination that they're willing to accept on their imports.
This is Lisa Wolf. She's also with EcoMaine, where we started this episode. EcoMaine, like so many companies, has a single-stream MRF. And theirs is pretty good. It gets a lot of contamination out.
The typical standard has been more like 3 to 5% contamination. So this is really creating a bit of a crisis for the recycling industry as a whole, because we're all set up to manage to that demand for 3 to 5% contamination, and now China is saying we will only accept 0.5%. So that's really where we're at right now.
In other words, China doesn't want to be our trash can anymore. And at EcoMaine and everywhere in the United States, that means our trash is piling up.
One of the things you'll notice when you go up there is there's quite a bit of paper on hand.
Lisa told me that EcoMaine has been finding buyers elsewhere. Thailand, Vietnam, India. It's slow going, but they haven't had to landfill anything yet. The unique thing about EcoMaine, though, is that they're a nonprofit. Their focus is keeping stuff out of the landfill, even when it costs them money. But for most of the world, recycling is big business. And that business isn't looking so hot right now.
You'll see that the 2016 fiscal year price was $101 per ton. In 2017, that went down to $51 per ton. Now we're looking at zero, sometimes having to pay $11 a ton to get rid of the paper.
Remember, recyclable materials are a commodity. at what happens when you take millions of tons of product out of one big market, China, and pour it into smaller markets like Vietnam and Thailand, the market floods. Value takes a nosedive. Combine that with factors like low oil prices that make recycled plastic less desirable, and you've got yourself a bit of an economic dilemma.
So what do you do when saving the planet stops making fiscal sense? That's when Outside In continues. Welcome back. I'm Sam Evans Brown, and this is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. Or in this case, how we reuse it. Or maybe more accurately, how we think we're reusing it, but maybe we're just unwittingly dumping it in the landfill. Tell you what, I'll just let producer Han McCarthy keep telling the story.
Up here in the Northeast, when you start sniffing around the recycling industry, everybody tells you to talk to this guy.
My name is Mike Durfor. I'm the executive director for the Northeast Resource Recovery Association.
The NRRA, two R's there, was formed back in 1981 in New Hampshire with the idea of helping municipalities get their recyclables to market. Mike's been here since 2008.
And the message on my phone says, now's a great time to be in recycling. Everybody thinks I'm totally crazy.
Mike admits he has a hard time defending this position. The restrictions in China mean that processing has slowed down big time. The same amount of waste is coming in, but it takes much more effort to get the product in better shape, not to mention the fact that you need humans to do a lot of that sorting. And that's all on top of the value issue.
And the price went from 35 a ton to 70 a ton for a week, and then it went to 90 a ton the next week. And folks that are trying to budget for that are really caught because they can't. You can't foresee that kind of cataclysmic impact on the recycling market.
Remember, your town used to save money by recycling. That's because waste haulers used to be willing to pick up our newspapers and milk jugs for free because they could turn around and sell them for a profit. But with the market for recyclables now upside down, haulers are charging to pick up recycling, and towns are looking at costs they never expected. And suddenly, doing the environmentally friendly thing isn't going to make the taxpayers happy anymore.
We had a discussion yesterday with the municipality, and they're paying about $105 a ton for single-stream recycling. And at the same time, they have a contract for their municipal solid waste, their trash, for $68 a ton. So if it's going to cost you $105 over here and only $68 over there, you're probably going over there, especially if you have a tight budget.
And this isn't just pure conjecture. There are warning signs that this could soon be happening in the U.S. Just because we're ethically committed to recycling doesn't mean we can be practically committed to it.
What's happened in a number of states in the United States is that they have bans on throwing recyclables of any kind into landfills. And what we're seeing is in those states, they're currently issuing waivers in some cases to the haulers saying it's okay to throw it away now because we know you don't have a market to take it to. We don't want it on the side of the road. We're hoping the markets will come back, and when they do, then the waivers will be rescinded and go back to business as usual.
When we went to single stream, we were trying to make it easy to do the right thing. But now the contamination problem is threatening to torpedo the markets that make recycling work. Some recycling programs have already started asking residents to leave certain things out of the bin. Marion County in Oregon has banned shredded paper, egg cartons, milk boxes, and most plastic from the single stream bins. Madison, Wisconsin has banned plastics like 5-gallon buckets and children's toys. In the Australian state of Victoria, a waste hauler suspended collection entirely. Ireland, which was used to exporting 95% of its recycling to China, warns that it's on the brink of a waste management crisis. Remember, Mike Durfor truly believes that now is a great time to get into the recycling business, and we're going to come back to that. But first, I've got to tell you, at this point in my reporting, my recycling romanticism had been totally dashed. I had no idea that my ability to recycle something hung in the balance of an import-export relationship. I mean, isn't that little recycling symbol supposed to mean something? I'd spent my whole life thinking of recyclables as a kind of environmental currency with a certain guaranteed value. That value being that my stuff didn't end up in a landfill. It never occurred to me that that stuff has literal monetary value in a complicated market. And the way that I had gone about recycling, the whole single stream, occasional, wishful recycling thing, it wasn't helping things. It might even be making it worse. To be clear, single stream does increase recycling rates, but it's problematic for other reasons. I talked to one recycler, Richard Bowl, who told me that single stream has never served the market. Richard's been in the business for 28 years, running an old school facility where everything has to be separated.
So over the years, I have learned this, what I call a truism, that to get the best prices in the market, and sometimes any prices at all, you have to have everything almost perfectly sorted.
Richard pointed out that China has been pushing for cleaner recycling for a while now. National Sword is just the latest in their insistence on a better product. And either way, he says, this is a commodities market. Recyclables will ultimately always have to be sorted really well to eventually be worth something.
With the low oil prices, low plastic prices mean that the only way you could possibly sell the recycled plastics is by having them almost perfectly sorted. Now, going to single stream, where you throw everything together and then usually pick it up in a trash truck and compress it and break some of the glass and treat it like that, is not a way, in my view, to treat recyclables.
Richard wrote an op-ed for an industry magazine saying that he was aghast when single stream was introduced. It's treating recyclables like garbage, he says. And that doesn't make any sense. So to Richard, it'd probably be no surprise that some of our recycling isn't just being handled like garbage, it's becoming garbage. And as far as landfilling goes, we've got the space for it. Arkansas, for example, has said that it can go about 600 years before its dumps run out of space and they need to build another one.
It's not the world as we might have known it a while ago.
This is Mike Durfor again. He's the guy who thinks that now is a great time to get into the recycling business. Because there is a silver lining to all of this, as it turns out. It's a chance to build a different, stronger system that can withstand shifts. And while it might sound counterintuitive, the solution to this whole mess might be to double down on the logic of single stream and to get rid of separate bins altogether.
There are a number of initiatives around the country that are looking at things like one bin, where all your trash and your recyclables would go in together. And they're specifically designed to deal with that type of contamination, whereas the facilities that are just designed for recycling only aren't, and that's where it's causing them a problem.
Mike says this one bin system would require better, more magical, more Willy Wonka-esque MRFs that were specifically designed to really, truly get the contamination out. The process is praised for being easier for consumers and increasing recycling rates and diverting nearly all trash from the landfill.
Single stream plants are trying to remake an omelet, if you will, and they've actually, after the egg's been cracked, they tout their process as saying there's no such thing as waste. There's only materials that can be reused. And that's how they design their facility. And like I say, they put a lot of investment into the equipment to get that separated out.
Mike told me the one bin system is working in some countries in Europe, but in the U.S. it's still pretty new, and that's intimidating. It takes buy-in from politicians and from the community. A one-bin MRF in Montgomery, Alabama, went bankrupt a few years ago, and an attempt to institute the system in Houston, Texas, died after years of research and negotiating. So, in a way, this is an opportunity for someone to step in and build a better recycling system, one that can crank out a genuinely clean product at a reasonable price. Or it's an opportunity for landfills. After all, we didn't start them, but they're always there if we need them.
That's producer Hannah McCarthy. So, Sam.
Taylor.
Listeners may remember our segment Ask Sam, where you answer random audience questions about stuff like animals and the environment or whatever.
1-844-GO-OTTER.
Well, in the spirit of today's show on magical thinking, we're going to do a little bit of rebranding, okay?
I'm not sure I'm okay with this.
Okay, all right.
When you like to do a thing because you think that it's a good thing. And you tell Sam and he says,
That's a bad thing.
People everywhere are gonna do their thing, but Sam ruined it.
Oh, jeez. Well, I like that we're fully, you know, turning me into a cartoon character. I'm ready for it.
My name is Catherine, and I was wondering the other day, how much it costs on average to ride in the elevator instead of taking the stairs. I was in a building in Austin, Texas, that was just a two-story building with a very, very slow, big elevator. And it struck me as kind of silly to take the elevator. And then I thought, you know, I wonder what it costs in terms of like installing the elevator, maintenance and upkeep on the elevator, and then just the energy to make it go up and down. Thanks. Bye.
Do you guys take the elevator every day?
I tend to take it up mm-hmm. and then take the stairs down.
Uh-huh. I do a little bit of both. If I'm in a rush, I'll take the elevator, and I don't know if that actually makes sense.
It's actually, I'm not sure that this is the perfect thing for the Sam Ruined It segment.
I thought for sure you were going to tell us that elevators are like costly and put out tons of carbon and...
Well, okay, so what I know about elevators is that they're actually a very efficient way to move people through space because they're like, it's basically like a train, right? They're like a train car on some rails that goes up and down instead of side to side. And not only that, they have this thing called a counterweight, which is as the elevator goes up, there's a weight that's going down, right? And the counterweight is depending on the elevator, it weighs about as much as the thing when it's loaded to like 40% capacity. Mm-hmm. So you can think of it almost like a seesaw, yeah. Right? Yeah.
Or a grandfather clock.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
And so like if you're thinking about a seesaw, like it doesn't take a ton of effort to push, like even if you're with a pretty big person on the other side, it doesn't take a ton of effort to push them up into the air. And then when you're lowering them back down, when you're coming back down, that's no work because the weight is sort of like doing the work for you.
Yeah.
I did Google this at one point, and like the energy used by elevators in large office buildings is actually less than the energy saved when they went from like regular to CFL light bulbs.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's very small amount of energy
wow.
in the grand scheme of things.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Well, you officially haven't ruined elevators then.
Yeah.
Got to ruin something else.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. For the purpose of this segment, you still need to ruin something. So, Sam, what do you got?
What? Just on the spot? Just
yeah.
like that?
Yeah.
How about artisanal light bulbs?
What? That's a thing?
Have you ever like gone to a restaurant and seen like the old-timey looking long...
Oh, I love those.
Yeah.
Like the Edison
so
incandescent.
So stupid. So stupid.
Do you mean from an efficiency standpoint?
Yes. They're like 10 times less efficient. And why? And why? Because they look old. And people are like, well, that looks old.
Okay, just one more thing. Ruin one more thing.
Something that people really love.
Hybrid cars.
What? No. That's an episode. You can't just ruin hybrid cars real quick during an Ask Sam.
They're not much better for the environment than regular cars.
No way. What about when I finally get my Tesla? Will I be a champion of...
Electric cars are okay. better than hybrid cars. Right. The problem with a hybrid car is you've got two drivetrains in one, and you've got this giant battery, and you've got this giant gas engine, and so like... You know, first of all, you add layers of cost but just generally not that much more efficient.
So do you mean like, so a solar panel, for example, it creates carbon in its manufacturing process, but eventually, you know, you can sort of make that back because it's energy. And in the case of a hybrid car, there's just so much stuff in a hybrid car because you have to have the two drivetrains that it takes much longer to recoup that investment.
Yes. And not only that, they are not
they're not so much more efficient than a regular car that they're like recouping it really quickly, right? So you know, the Prius gets like 50 miles to the gallon if you're lucky. If you drive like many normal people, they get more like 40 miles to the gallon. You can find a small, just a regular car that gets 40 miles to the gallon.
My Honda Civic gets around that, yeah.
And so for all that, you know, expense and batteries and having a new drivetrain in there, you get what? A couple miles per gallon.
Dang.
All right.
You did ruin it.
Ruined. Outside In was produced this week by Taylor Quimby, Hannah McCarthy, and me, Sam Evans-Brown, with help from Justine Paradise and Jimmy Gutierrez. Erica Janik is our executive producer. Maureen McMurray is the director of Yes, Take a Longer Road Trip Than You Were Planning On. Special thanks to Joe Ayotte, Nelson Analytical, Jess Nolan, Jared Starr, and the folks at New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. Also thanks to Cordelia Zars for the Sam Ruined It idea, and to the one-man barbershop quartet that is Nick Cavadice for the Sam Ruined It theme song. Music in this episode by Komiku, Jason Leonard, Blue Dot Sessions, Poddington Bear, and Ari De Niro. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.